KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Kimberly Cortez, reporting intern at Street Roots, to talk about her latest story for the paper. It's called City Contractors Post Sweep Notifications Amid Heat Wave. Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency July 2nd due to extreme heat, but city contractors continued posting sweep notifications on homeless encampments throughout the emergency. Welcome to the show, Kimberly.
Hi, Althea.
Thank you so much for being here. So, data analysis by Street Roots found that a city contractor, Rapid Response BioClean, posted 121 encampment sweep notifications during the heat wave and during the state of emergency. How did you determine this, and what is so significant about it?
Yeah, so the Homeless and Urban Camping Impact Reduction Program, or HUCURP, posts sort of this data every single week, just giving the public an insight on how many encampments are sleeping a week, you know, how many of those people went to shelters. And we were aware of postings happening, or actual sweeps happening, because this isn't the first time that the city has said that they were going to pause, you know, sweeping encampments during an extreme weather emergency. In the story, I talk about how this happened in 2022. So we were sort of aware that something might have happened during that, you know, first week of July, where, you know, there's just record-breaking heat. So the analysis that we did was from that data that was shared with us. And what we found was that while the city was not necessarily claiming that they were sweeping, they were still posting these notifications. And, you know, 121 of those were posted for removal July 3rd through July 9th. And in between those dates, they were still posting sweep notifications when temperatures were exceeding 99 degrees or reaching that. And while the city is technically allowed to do that, despite what they lay out in their own policy around stopping sweeps during heat emergencies or other weather-related emergencies, they were still sweeping when it was in the mid-90s the following week. So really what we found was that, you know, even though there's this difference between posting the notifications and actually sweeping, there was still harm being done.
I think it's also worth noting that in your reporting, you talk about how the story was shifting as you were talking to HUCURP about this and what they were claiming that the city contractor, Rapid Response BioClean, was up to. Just a brief quote. Laura Rude, HUCURP Communications and Data Coordinator, initially told Street Roots the city's contractors only collected trash during the heat wave in a July 10th email. Rude later acknowledged the city also had contractors continue posting sweep notifications in a July 15 email.
Yeah, we initially asked, when we initially asked for the data, they told us, you know, there might not be as many encampment removals because we stopped having crews doing sweeps, and they were just picking up garbage. And those days where it was really hot, the crews were just out until 12 p.m. So they had a shortened work day that week of the heat wave. But when the HUCURP source later shared some notes with us from the actual crew, we found that they did at least sweep one encampment during the days that they said that they were just picking up garbage. The crew notes say, you know, campers got their stuff and left. This was marked as removed.
So we know that there was sweep postings and some sweeps that were happening during this time. How do people usually react when they see that sign, when they see the sweep posting near where they've been sleeping?
A sweep notification inform homeless Portlanders that city contractors will return in 72 hours to 10 days to remove their encampments. But what Portland, what homeless Portlanders have told us before is that they leave before that initial 72-hour period even is up, because when contractors do come and sweep, it typically involves the contractors seizing and potentially disposing any property. So to ensure that they can get as many of their belongings as possible, sometimes these belongings are also crucial to getting into a traditional shelter. They leave before that initial time period is up. And so I think that's where it gets sort of tricky with the city's own policy, is that, you know, those sleep notifications that they were giving to encampment sites on the days that it said that it was just picking up garbage, the 10-day period still extends to when they actually did those. So it's kind of complicated, the differentiation between posting and actually sweeping. But what advocates also told us was that they saw and witnessed and have peers that witnessed sweeps occurring. So it makes you question whether the data that the city is having, that the city is collecting, paints an accurate picture of what's really happening on the street.
Well, yeah, let's go there, right? Like you said, there's the official account of what happened and when, what rapid response crews were doing during the heat wave, but advocates have a different story. Let's go into that. What did they see?
Yeah, so I reached out to Portland Street Medicine, which regularly provides healthcare and other important resources for homeless Portlanders on the street. And when I asked them, you know, this is what the city is saying, they said that they were not removing any encampments. What do you have to say? Almost all of them had a rebuttal. One person said that they saw sweeps occurring in Old Town. Another person said that, you know, right when they were looking at the city's dashboard, they connected with someone who was helping a homeless Portlander not get swept the days that the heat were very excessive. So I think what advocates are sort of asking the city is for more transparency on city policy. You know, they have this differentiation between posting and actually sweeping, but their experience is different, and some clarity on what their procedure actually is during extreme weather events is crucial to understanding what kind of resources and other needs that they would need to supply homeless Portlanders with.
Well, off of that point, what kind of risks do people face on the street when it reaches those extremely high temperatures?
Portland Street Medicine had varying responses. And, you know, there's obviously the physical aspect of it all. Having to physically remove your belongings in extreme heat poses, you know, so many health risks. And also those risks aren't spread evenly among all homeless Portlanders. Portland Street Medicine acknowledge that those who are disabled or sick are made even more vulnerable when they're put in that extremely compromising position. And they also pointed out that there's sort of this mental effect as well. The sweeps don't just affect the physical body, but your mental state and how it can really set you back on all the momentum that you've been building on to improve your situation. Not to mention that when sweeps do occur, sometimes the contractors take very pivotal information that is needed to access stable housing, employment, or traditional shelters. You know, IDs can be lost and other important paperwork. I think that advocates would say that there's, you know, so many more risks than people think to being swept during extreme weather events.
I mean, those of us that were in the area when it was happening, you really don't want to be outside.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that a tent could be crucial to surviving in that heat, actually providing you a physical form of shade. I think that they said those things are really crucial to someone who doesn't have that much.
Well, with these sort of shifting stories about what was happening and when, did Huckerb give you a justification about why rapid response was still on the job during this extreme heat?
Yeah, they told me it was a balancing act, which can be interpreted in many ways. But I think from their perspective, the city contracts rapid response. And when they aren't doing that job, they're at a loss for money. And, you know, that's the only explanation they were really able to give us, is that rapid response essentially also has a job. And when these events do happen, they try their hardest to give these employees other options so they're not missing work days.
You touched on this a little bit, but I want to connect it to that historical piece. Sweeping unhoused Portlanders during a heat wave or during an extreme weather event, is this something the city has a history of doing?
Unfortunately, it is. StreetRoots reported previously that contractors swept as many as 8 sites during extreme heat in 2022 when temperatures reached up to 102 degrees. And again, these are just moments that we were able to track. And what advocates are saying is that this is not the most accurate depiction of what's actually happening on the streets. Sweeps happen during extreme weather events when the city says it doesn't. And that's a real issue because it exhausts their resources and it also puts people in danger. Now, granted, the city, I guess the county, in a July 12 press release said that, you know, it got 600 or more people into cooling shelters. It was providing water bottles and electrolyte packets and sunscreen packets and a whole plethora of resources. And advocates are saying that we need more of that. And even if they find out later on that not all of these, you know, resources are necessary or useful, it's still more than doing nothing, or worse, actually sweeping.
What do you want readers and listeners to take away from this story?
I think something that I want readers to think about is that this is not going to be the last extreme weather event that Portlanders experience in the coming years. There's this really kind of nuanced point about climate-related events and how those will only escalate in time as we see climate change worsen. And the city is not necessarily putting forth a transparent or clear plan to what it's going to do when those events happen and how that pertains to its response to homelessness in Portland. You know, that same week that heat emergency happened and the heat wave happened, it was the first week of the camping ban that was supposed to be put in place. And so there needs to be more transparency and clear guidelines on what happens when, you know, it's 100 degrees, what happens when it's less than 20 degrees, and how to respond and make sure that lives aren't lost.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find the full story for themselves?
You can find this story in this week's paper from your local StreetRoots vendor.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Kimberly Cortez, reporting intern at StreetRoots, speaking with me about her latest story for the paper. It's called City Contractors Post Sweep Notifications Amid Heat Wave. Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency July 2nd due to extreme heat, but city contractors continued posting sweep notifications on homeless encampments throughout the emergency. More information on that story is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community. We'll be right back.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's hot out. You know it. I know it. As much as it's been recognized that the human-caused climate crisis is contributing to higher temperatures and heat waves, our built environment can do the same, especially in cities. It's called the urban heat island effect, which basically means that cities experience much warmer temperatures than nearby rural areas do. But just how much of an impact does this effect have, and how is it connected to the environment in different neighborhoods? Climate Central looked at this question in new research released on July 10th. Across the country, they looked at 65 major cities and estimated how much hotter it gets than baseline in different neighborhoods because of what residents have built there. Of the 50 million people included in the analysis, 68% lived in an area with an urban heat island index of 8 degrees or more. So when the forecast says it's going to be 80 degrees, people experience a temperature of 88 degrees in those neighborhoods. In Portland specifically, 60,000 people live in parts of the city that have a UHI index of 9 degrees or more. But what exactly are the factors that make different neighborhoods hotter? The first one is called albedo. Here's the MIT Concrete Sustainability Hub to explain.
If you've ever walked barefoot on pavement in the summer sun, you probably know how burning hot it can get. This phenomenon, as it turns out, is more than just a nuisance. It actually has a dramatic impact on our daily lives, from the Earth's climate to human health. We refer to it as albedo. Here's how it works. Solar radiation constantly enters the atmosphere, where it is either absorbed or reflected by the Earth's surface. While the energy that is absorbed stays and warms the Earth, the reflected energy travels back to the atmosphere, some of which is returned to space. Albedo is a measure of this reflected radiation. The higher the albedo, the more energy is reflected, and the lower the albedo, the more energy is absorbed. We can actually measure the magnitude of albedo, in large part due to color. Lighter colored surfaces reflect more radiation, which we perceive as light, and have a higher albedo. On the other hand, darker surfaces absorb more light and have a lower albedo. So what impact does albedo have on our lives? When sunlight hits a city, dark man-made surfaces on pavements and roofs absorb this energy and begin to heat up. This warms surrounding areas throughout the day and long after the sun sets.
There are two other factors that influenced the urban heat island index too, along with albedo. The percentage of green space makes a difference. Plants help cool the air through a process called evapotranspiration, and less vegetation means less cooling. If you've spent any hot summer days in the forest, you may have felt the difference. Plants can help reduce peak summer temperatures in cities between 2 and 9 degrees, one study found. The other big factor is population density. Lots of human activities create extra heat. Think transportation, industrial facilities, and cooling down buildings. So sun-absorbing surfaces like roads, less green space, and high population density contribute to higher temperatures in urban areas. It's worth noting that extreme heat is the deadliest weather-related hazard in the U.S., so tackling urban heat islands could really make a difference as our weather gets more extreme because of the climate crisis. To learn more about this research, I spoke with Jen Brady, Senior Data Analyst at Climate Central. Thank you for being here. So we're talking about your new analysis of urban heat islands. Talk me through this, sort of the basic top line stuff here. What was it that you sought to measure in this work?
Right. Well, we focus on climate change. And a lot of times climate change is confused with urban heat islands, and they're separate. And so we wanted to really kind of distinguish between the two. The fact that there's baseline temperatures going up everywhere, whether you're in a city or not in a city. But in the city, there's an additional risk because temperatures are warmer in the city, basically because of two really broad things, which are the built environment, buildings, streets, and population density. So all the heat we produce living every day. And so we wanted to put some measures on that so people could see what the estimated additional risk was for people in different cities, and maybe provide a guide for folks to know what neighborhoods and what areas of the city might be most at risk.
Talk me through a little bit of the methodology. How did you go about measuring this kind of thing?
Yeah, ice is a little different. So a lot of people would have measured urban heat island, which is good because I think they all work together to kind of give us a more complete picture. Our method was a broader method, and we used a model value. And basically, the model builds in the types of design in the city. Is it dense building structure? Is it skyscrapers? Is it parkland? And then it also builds in population density. And based on those values, researchers have estimated how much additional heat that will provide to an area. And so we were able to, there's been some great research done really plotting the whole country, the land cover of the whole country. And we were able to look at all these different cities and outside of cities as well and say, this is the land cover. And based on that, this is how much additional heat there will be in this area.
So, right, your analysis looked at 65 different U.S. cities.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the trends that you noticed around the country?
Well, the kind of the baseline temperature we found that really existed in all the cities was 8 degrees. So that's really where all the cities had at least some measurable part of their population that was living at an area that was 8 degrees warmer than it would be otherwise if it was not for the built environment around them. And so that was kind of the big one. Some people, you know, some cities, the temperatures would go up to 10, 12 degrees, maybe even higher. But really, that 8-9 degree spot was really the sweet spot across the West. And that's a lot of heat, really, because if you're talking about 80-degree temperatures, that could mean your day feels like it's 89, 90 degrees. So that, I think, would be the main finding. And knowing that more and more people live in urban environments now, there's more and more people who are going to be at risk.
Well, and you also looked at Portland, Oregon, where I am speaking to you from.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you notice about the maps of Portland?
Well, Portland there seems to be two ways that cities have their heat distributed. They have either a kind of an urban core, and the heat is really focused in the urban core. You'll see that maybe in like Chicago, I think, is a good example of that. You'll see kind of this spot in the middle, and that's where the heat is. Cleveland has that too. And then other cities tend to be more West Coast cities, Southwest cities, and some cities in Florida. The heat is more dispersed, which seems to represent a different growth pattern in those cities, and that maybe there isn't just this one urban core where everyone lives, but there's different densities around the city, different growth patterns around the city. And that's what we saw more for Portland, was some hot spots kind of scattered around the Portland area.
Obviously, urban heat islands are a big issue, and you know, we're talking now at the end of Portland's first big heat wave of the summer, where at least 6 people have died in connection to the heat wave, many of them actually in southeast Portland. What does your research indicate to policymakers? Is that part of the conversation as well, as how to act on this kind of information?
Well, our goal is to really get the information out to the communicators of the world to help tell the story of where this is happening and how this is happening. And then hopefully the policymakers or even community organizations or citizens will pick it up and say, okay, what can we do about this now that we've realized it's not just our imagination. There's a real problem here, and there's a real issue that's making us feel hotter. I think it's easy for sometimes you say, oh, I'm just, you know, I just think I'm feeling hotter. But in these places, it truly is. And so hopefully then solutions can be targeted in a way to maybe the places that need it the most right now, and then rolled out more gradually into places that are maybe in a little better shape at this time.
You mentioned some of the things that you measured that are known to contribute to a higher urban heat island in this index, that having to do with the built environment, how much paving there is. What are some of the things that are maybe the opposite of that cut down on this extra heat spike?
Yeah, this is one interesting thing about this topic, is there are solutions, and there's solutions at different scales. Say a neighborhood that we have to take action, and we want to take action right now, and we can't wait for our city to take action. They might decide to put up something as simple as umbrellas along the street or some sort of awnings along the street to cool the street where their residents are walking or sitting or standing at the bus stop, or trees. Trees is always a favorite, but trees sometimes take longer to grow. So that's kind of one of the problems with trees. You don't always get the shade immediately, but maybe you decide to plant some trees. Maybe you decide there's a big swath of pavement. Maybe it's something that was abandoned. And it would be cooler if you made that into a community garden, say. And these things, like I said, they could be in very small size, or they could be in a bigger size, where a whole city makes an effort to identify these kind of neighborhoods and spots and make these bigger changes. And then there's engineering changes, which seems to be a lot of experimentation with now. You may have heard about their painting pavement lighter colors, so it's more reflective in some cities. White roofs have been popular for a while to reflect, or green roofs, so you also reduce the amount of heat that absorbs. So those are obviously bigger engineering solutions that are probably going to need to be done by cities or building owners. But there's a whole range, which is a really nice thing about this problem being able to be solved.
I think that it is at a stage, especially for Portland right now, where, you know, we can look to other cities who have much more of a history with intense heat. We're not really used to it here. And, you know, our built environment doesn't reflect kind of the needs of how extremely hot it's been getting.
Right. And so many of them have traditionally been built to keep us warmer. And it's just a design choice. When you're thinking, oh, what do we need from this building? We need this building to keep us warm. And now more and more months of the year, we really need to keep cool. Another advantage that places like Portland and Seattle have, that where the heat is really emerging and some of the systems are going into places, they can do it the right way and the best way. You know, sometimes you walk through older cities on the East Coast, there's a lot of window units that spew a lot of heat out the back of them. You know, maybe when buildings go up or when air conditioning now is installed in buildings in the Northwest where it wasn't before, it can be done in a more efficient way, a cleaner way, a way that's not going to distribute waste heat, but a way that's also going to use the grid more efficiently and use less carbon, which is just adds to the vicious cycle of this. So there's an opportunity there for your area to kind of build into a hot zone in a better way.
Another thing that's mentioned in your research is how this urban heat is unequally distributed and how that lines up in some ways with the history of racial redlining. Can you touch on that issue a little bit?
I won't go too in depth because that was conducted by our friends at Columbia University, and they were kind enough to let us kind of have that study with ours so we could give people that additional resource. And what they looked at was cities all around the country and looked at where were the historically redlined districts. And they found in those areas that temperatures tended to be hotter than in the areas that were not historically redlined. And, you know, it varies from city to city, but it was a pattern overall across the country. So, again, that may help people if they want to go in. And like you said, you know, Portland is kind of at the beginning of this thought about, you know, what are we going to do when it gets really hot? Maybe that'll help you say, these are the neighborhoods that are probably most at risk, and we should target them in our efforts.
You've touched on this a little bit, but how do you feel that your analysis with Climate Central fits into other urban heat island research? Where is it in that conversation?
Yeah, ours is kind of a broader scope. A lot of people, what they'll do is they'll go out on like a few days of the year and take temperatures. So that's very helpful to give you kind of an actual temperature on this block or this neighborhood. Like I said, other people have looked at heat in particular neighborhoods that maybe are lower income or traditionally with discriminated populations. So I'm hoping that ours is just kind of another piece. We're able to take a broader look too, because you don't need as many resources to go into 65 cities if you are doing a more modeled approach. So we're hoping also it can maybe provide some cities that don't have the resources to do the really in-depth analysis some starting point to think about. So hopefully it kind of is part of the bigger picture. And with all these things, we're going to start to really be able to focus in on what the problem is.
And off of your analysis, are there more questions to be answered? Like where might research go after this?
Oh, I think, yeah, there's definitely always more questions to be answered. Probably the big one is to continue to look at the demographics and how different populations are affected. Whether that be age or race. So that's another one that always needs more analysis. And then I think we need to start looking at how the solutions are working, because people are putting solutions into place. So it'll be interesting to see if people can start measuring, you know, this neighborhood maybe we looked at
10 years ago didn't have any parks, didn't have any green space. Now it does. How much cooler is it in that neighborhood? Really like to see the success of some of the solutions being documented.
That was Jen Brady, Senior Data Analyst at Climate Central, speaking with me about a new study out July 10th on urban heat islands. Their analysis showed that nearly 34 million U.S. residents in the nation's biggest cities live in a neighborhood where the built environment around them makes it feel 8 or more degrees hotter. More information on their research is online at climatecentral.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Listen to Armando Puentes every Sunday from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., playing the best in Tejano mixing with some traditional